Faith-inspiring radio. This is UCB Ireland.
Joining me on the phone is a very good friend. It is Mark Morgan from Stella's Voice. Mark, how are you?
Good, thank you, Robbie. Good to be with you. Good to be on this call today. Glad to be here.
It is great to have you with us today, and this is Focus on Friday. So we're going to be focusing on the man that is Mark Morgan, and eventually focusing on the work, the incredible work that Mark has been doing for many, many years. We're going to just hang that, leave it hanging, and we'll come back to what Mark actually does with Stella's Voice in just a few minutes' time. But if I can, if you're happy for me to do, I'd like to find out a little bit about young Mark. Little Mark. How was childhood?
Yeah. Childhood was good. I was born and grew up in the valleys of South Wales, in the atypical mining community. That was my upbringing.
You don't sound Welsh.
Well, nearly 37 years living in North East Scotland would do that to you.
So it was a big family you had?
I'm the oldest of four siblings. Normal-sized family back then, you know, that was a normal thing. And by, you know, a regular-sized family, if I could use that phrase, just nothing out of the ordinary.
So school life, you were a good student, average student? How did it go?
I loved school. I loved school my whole school life, right up until it was time to leave, and then I wanted to leave, but, you know, I'll come to that later. But no, I loved school, and of course, back then, everything was close, so, you know, we all lived in the streets around the school, we all walked to school, there was no, you know, very few people got a lift to school back in those days, so it was very much a community upbringing. Your school friends were your friends you played with outside of school, your socialising and everything else all revolved around that kind of same group of people that we all grew up together, and no, school was good.
Yeah, I remember my own childhood. You remember some of the ways you used to get out and play out in the, you know, in the green and play football and things. Any for you, any kind of residing memories of childhood?
Oh yeah. So I lived, living in the valleys. You live on a hill. You either live at the bottom or the top.
Right.
We were at the top of the hill, three doors down from the top, on a cul-de-sac, on a very steep hill, and then began the forestry.
Okay.
So my childhood was, we'd be off for, you know, hours at a time, up playing, climbing trees, making dens, digging holes, just all the kind of crazy stuff you would do. One of my fondest memories was, and I couldn't have been much more than seven, if that, and I'd managed to climb this tree that I'd been trying to climb for years, but I was too small, and I got to the top. My mum came out to shout me in for supper.
And you're at the top of the tree.
Couldn't see me, and I shouted from the top of the tree I was so delighted I'd made it to the top of this tree, and my mum's response was to go and get my dad and help get me down, because, you know, and looking back through it now, if my 8-year-old had done or 7-year-old had done that, I'd have had a heart attack too. But, you know, no awareness of the danger I was in. I was a good 30, 40 feet up on this tree. No idea of how I was going to get down. But yeah, that was my upbringing, and I loved it, the great outdoors.
We just didn't have any of those kind of fears, did we? We just got on with it. It was there to be conquered.
Well, it was, and when you fell and bumped yourself, you got, you know, that's what taught you, take care next time, don't be so stupid next time, that's how you learn.
Yeah, don't do it again, yeah.
Bumps and bruises are part of the learning process. If you're saved from the bumps and bruises, I think sometimes you don't learn in the way that you maybe could or should.
And what about your siblings then? You get on well with them?
Yeah, so, like I said, I'm the oldest. So myself and my brother, he's just 2.5 years younger than me, so we were very close in age, and life, if I can use that phrase. Then my next brother has, there's almost a 10-year gap between us.
Right.
And then my sister is, again, there's about 12 and a half years between me and my youngest sibling, my sister. So those two had kind of a very different upbringing to us, simply because, by the time they were born, the decline had set in, the miners were on strike, mining, which was the 80% of the employment in where I grew up, had died almost overnight. We moved house. And life changed very quickly, rapidly from that point on. So get on well with them, get on fine. But there's that difference, if I can use that phrase.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
Almost like that generational gap between us, if that makes sense.
It's like, it's almost like two families, almost.
Yeah, very much so, yeah.
That must have been hard for all of you, really, with that kind of, especially with the strikes that came along, because, you know, the miner strikes in the 80s were horrific.
Yeah, the miners' strikes were brutal. From obviously through the eyes of a child, you didn't fully grasp Owl's Here as it was.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that stick in my memory from that kind of age bracket, bearing in mind I was 9, 10 when all this was happening, was, you know, people were going hungry. There were call them food banks nowadays, but there wasn't such a thing as a food bank back then, but there were collections of food going on and things like that, because it was that crazy. It was just, you know, because it wasn't just the mines and the miners and all the support industries. The shops shut overnight because all their business went because nobody had any money, you know.
There was nothing to buy.
85% employment.
Yeah, no one could buy anything.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Were you destined to become a miner? Was that where you were going?
No, I was never going to be a miner. My dad wasn't, my grandfather, my dad's dad was, and he was in the mines. My dad had been on the Forestry Commission his whole life up until that point. He'd
left school
and worked in the Forestry Commission. And that was never going to be my pathway. I knew from a young age that we're not exactly where, but, you know, calling, if I can use that phrase.
And what is it you wanted to do then?
So, I'm fortunate enough that, although when I was born, my parents weren't saved, my mum had been raised in a Christian home. And from the age of 2, she put me to Sunday school.
Okay.
And, you know, wanted that input into my life. And I came out of school, I was 7 years of age, one afternoon, and I remember it. I can see it in my mind's eye now. And there was a Sunday school teacher. His name's Granville Hawkins. I'm still in touch with him to this day. He was standing there. And I recognised him from Sunday school, and he was handing out leaflets to a 5-day kids club. He says, come along, it's going to be great, it's going to be so much fun. We've got this character called Robbie the Robot, you know. So I went along, and again, I can remember the setting. There are these huge boxes of sweets with, like, halfpenny Mojo chews and blackjacks and fruit salads, and all the stuff that you know, the classic 70s.
The classic sweets.
And they did memory verses and quizzes and games. It was magic. It was packed the whole week. And you had to learn a memory verse each day. There were prizes and stickers and all sorts of stuff. During that week, they put out an appeal and basically said, if you want to ask Jesus into your heart and into your life, and obviously they'd been working towards this throughout the week, and they said, I want you to go home and get down beside your bed tonight and pray that prayer, and then I want you to write it on a note and give it to me tomorrow. Bring back it tomorrow and tell me. So I went home and did that. And I did it because watching him and listening to him, there was no doubt in my mind Jesus was real. The life of God came through him. That's the only way I can explain it. And as much as a 7-year-old can understand that, I understood it. Incidentally, a couple of years ago, I was down to visit him. He lives in a different part of the UK now. And he pulled out a box and he handed me the note that I handed him when I was 7 years old.
Wow.
Of me telling him how I had Jesus into my heart.
That's a remarkable man.
Yeah. He is. He's something else. He really is. He's amazing and a key player, if I can use that phrase, that God used that shaped me and is why who I am today. I took a picture of it. I've got a picture of that very letter on my phone. But from that day forward, I just knew somehow my life was going to be, God was taking care of it. I didn't have any plans, you know. I mean, I did the whole usual thing as a kid in primary school. I was going to be an astronaut. I was going to be a policeman. I wanted to be a detective, you know, all this sort of stuff. But what changed for me was at the age of 13, going on 14, I got baptized in the church. And it was the same night, I believe, there was a prize given, and we all got given a book. And I got given a book. And it was a story, a testimony of some guy who was saved as a kid, young age, got called into ministry, went off to Bible school, and I'm reading the book, and as I'm reading it, it was like something inside me said, you're reading your life story here. And I knew it. I absolutely knew it. Not long afterwards, we came to the point in education where you had to choose the subjects you were doing.
Yeah.
For the next 2 years, back in the days of O-levels, show my age here. And you then, you know, because you had to decide what career path that you wanted to determine what subjects you were choosing best equipping you for that career path. And I remember in the kitchen with my mum deliberating, and she said, well, what are you going to choose? And I said, well, I want to go to Bible college.
Wow. How old are you?
14. And I just said, I'm going to Bible. I didn't know where. I didn't know what Bible college. I had no connections to anything or anybody. I just knew inside me, as much as I knew that Jesus saved me and he was real, I knew that's what I was going to do. Of course, when I discussed that with the career guidance teachers, they actually laughed to my face.
You didn't feel supported at all?
Oh, no, zero support. They laughed at me. They actually laughed at me. So I just chose subjects that I liked: history, geography, music, craft design, technology, all the stuff I either naturally like or I'm naturally good at. And I just did those subjects because I knew it was just a case of marking time.
And how long did you had to do your O-levels, of course. You were 14, so by the time you were 16, was it, your O-levels were done?
Yeah, so you chose, so then in the next 2 years of school, so in third year you chose your subjects for fourth and fifth year. So I chose my subjects, and then I started sixth form. And because one of the things my mum had always said was, unless you've got an option, a job, or a Bible college lined up, you're not just walking out of school and going on the door.
That's wise.
And I'd written at the time to two of the mainstream Bible colleges in this country, and just told them I felt the call of God in my life. I was, 16, going on 17, and nothing. They basically wrote back and said, write back when you're 18.
Wow.
Quite a flat response, to be honest. So I thought, okay. But inside, something told me it was time. And what added to it was, I'd loved school my whole life. I mean, I really, really enjoyed school. I enjoyed school. I enjoyed the community of school. I got involved in stuff. I was involved in extracurricular stuff. I just loved school. And this is from September to Christmas of 87. So I was 16. I just began to hate school. And by the January, I was like, I want to do anything but go to school.
Yeah.
But I'd been turned down by these two big Bible schools. And then my mum found an envelope in a drawer. I came off from school one day, and my mum found an envelope in a drawer from somebody that had visited an evangelist that had been to our area a few years earlier and had left my mum this information pack. She took it in a drawer. She was clearing out the drawer, and I'd come home from school that day. And she said, I found this in the drawer. She says, I really think you should fill in the application form, write a brief letter explaining the situation, see what they say. So this was the start of March. I wrote, told them the scenario. I got a handwritten letter back saying, basically, they'd accepted me. Term starts in April. Do you think you can make it? And on the 7th of April, 1988, I jumped on service bus 549 in Pontypridd in South Wales, and got off in Aberdeen 10:30 that night. And I took another bus to Peterhead. And I, furthest north I'd ever been in my life at that point was Manchester.
Peterhead's very north.
Very north, yeah. I thought I'd come to the edge of the world. I'd just turned 17 in the January of that year. And I had two suitcases with pretty much most of my entire life in, and came to Peterhead.
Did you not feel...
That's how that happened.
Did you not feel scared about that, or were you excited about it, or what?
Oh, I was nervous. I mean, again, and this is pre-mobile phones, pre-sat-nav, I'm on the bus, I'm okay. This is like, I have no idea where I'm going. I didn't have a credit card or a debit card and a few quid in my pocket and a packed lunch and some drinks, and that was it. But I knew. I just knew it was what God was asking of me. So I guess that overrode all the rationale part.
And was there ever a point in your teen years, from 14, when you felt and you knew you were going to go to Bible school, was there ever a point with those rejections that you went, I'm out of here. I'm not doing this. I'm gone.
Yes, there was one lesson, and it's one of my life lessons, if I can use that phrase. And it was not long before I actually got the letter to come to Bible school. I was buzzing because I knew this is what God had called me to do, and I was going to do what God had called me to do. And when I got the letters back from the two mainstream Bible schools that said no, I went from cloud nine to depths of despair, as much as you could as a 16-year-old, and I was just absolutely gutted. And then, of course, my mum found this envelope we wrote, and when they replied, of course, I came home, got the letter, and I was in my room, just kind of relieved, but still kind of, not sulking, but I guess sulking, for want of a better word. And I remember my mum and dad came into my room, and he said this. He says, right, lesson for you here, she said. If you believe that God has called you to do something, and circumstances happen to the contrary, he says, don't you let those circumstances dictate or change what you believe God has told or shown you.
It's good advice.
And it was one of those impactful moments that's never left me. Never left me. And probably looking back through life now, the amount of times I have referenced that, or God has used that reference point in my life to say, hold on. You know, because we all know the promises of God are one thing, the walking out and fulfillment of that is a whole other ball of wax.
Trusting the promise of God is a really, really difficult thing sometimes.
Extremely difficult, especially when everything to the contrary is happening around you.
So you end up in Peterhead, in the 80s, yep. 1988, and that was it then? You weren't going back? Did you have a plan to do your course and then head back to Wales, or how did that work?
Yeah, I was coming up to do a two-year course, and I thought I was coming back to Wales, and I'd probably be a pastor of some church somewhere, and, you know, that's what I thought was going to happen. Like I said, and I've never been in Scotland, never mind, you know, as far north as Peterhead. Didn't know anybody, had no previous connections to anybody that was here. And I got into Peterhead, it was 10 to 11 at night by the time I got off the bus. Somebody picked me up in the car. I got brought out some roads, pitch black, had no idea what I was. Came over the drive, and the only way I can explain this is I felt a physical sensation in my chest, like a click.
Wow.
And I just knew this was it. I didn't know what. I didn't know where I was. It was pitch black. I couldn't see anything. But I knew I was in the right place. That's it. That's all I knew.
Now, have you stayed in the same area of Peterhead all the time? Or you know, since the 80s, 88? Or is it a case of you moved out away from there and then came back? Or has it just been your home since?
I have not left since. I am still... The office I am sitting in right now is on the same site where I first came in back all those years ago.
And this was a Bible college for you, or was it? It was known as a Bible college.
It was known as a Bible college. There were other students here. I spent my first week crying myself to sleep every night.
Even though you knew it was your home.
Interesting characters here, and I thought, where have I come? I'm most homesick, you know. And again, like I'm saying. Calling home was expensive. There was a payphone, but, you know, I couldn't afford to call very often, so on and so forth. So contact maybe once or twice a week if I was lucky. You know, if you'd write letters and things like that. But I knew I was in the right place. I just knew I was in the place God wanted me to be.
There's an interesting bit there that I just want to just highlight a little bit, if I may do. Even though you knew you were in the right place, you still, as you said yourself, cried yourself to sleep for the first week. It's not easy. And was that just missing home and missing family, or what was that?
Oh, yeah. Massive missing home. I mean, you know, we talked about my siblings. My younger sister at that point was four.
Right, okay.
When I left home.
That was a big change then.
Big change to leave everybody and everything. And just because you can know something and know and be, you know, to the core of your being, know it's something and it's the plan of God and the purpose of God and the right thing for you. And like, walking it out is still hard. You know, there's still that... you know, human emotions and natural things that you know, even down to simple things like the creature comforts that we all like, and you know, a strange bed, strange environment, all new people, one of the youngest people here, all of that going on.
You see, for me, that's such an important thing to get across, that even when God calls you to somewhere, it's not all rosy in the garden, and you've got to adjust.
Yeah. Oh, it's. It's tough. It can be really tough at times. And, you know, obviously, you know, the older you get, the hopefully you get a little bit wiser and you learn a bit more. And when I was younger, you know, and it's not often, but now and again, somebody would come and say, you know, I've got a prophetic word for you. And
right.
You used to think, wow, well, you used to hear somebody else getting a prophetic word. And you think, God, why have you not got one for me?
Yeah, I want one of them.
But I can probably count three or four times in my entire life where that has happened.
Right.
And I tell you one thing, I don't crave them, because what I have learned is whilst they have been amazing and impactful in my life, they've been what God has given me to hold on to, because what was about to follow would challenge every belief and conviction and, you know, that I had within me.
Yeah.
And sometimes that word from him was the only thing you could hold on to, because your world is about to get shaken beyond what you can understand, blown apart more than you think it can happen, and all these sorts of things. So you learn as you get older to not, it's like, God, don't give me a word, because I know that you're already giving me that to hold on to because of what's coming. I'd rather just have the plain sailing, please.
Just let me just bob along here. That's the best thing. I'm happy to just bob along, because like you say, when God speaks, then action is required or challenges on the way. So you were then, you were 17 when you went to Peterhead, and yeah. you've lived there ever since. Did you know what you wanted to do with your life? I know you were in Bible college, but did you know what, when you finished college, it was a 2-year course, what was going to happen at the end of that?
Well, my initial thought was, I thought I was going to be a pastor.
Right.
And I thought I was going to be pastoring a church. But no, that didn't happen. I'd only been here, I'm trying to think, I'd been there for 18 months or so, and I was asked to get involved in a kids' evangelistic crusade down in England.
Right.
A tent mission, and went down there, loved it. And I'd always been able to connect with kids. I'd be in a room of adults and kids, and just sitting there minding my business, and the kids would always end up gathering around me, and I just seemed to be able to connect with them. Now, there is a school of thought out there that people say it's because they're on the same, I'm on the same wavelength as them, but that's another story.
I'm not saying anything.
joking apart, there was calling. That's the only way I can explain it. And I then got involved in kids' work, and that ballooned and mushroomed over the years into a lot of things. You know, schools work, secondary schools, primary schools work. I've been involved in training conferences for other kids' ministries. We've done international stuff over the years. And that bloomed and grew and blossomed into lots of things. And that was just one of a dozen avenues that over the years, God began to open up in things that I didn't even see coming, wasn't expecting, wasn't looking for. And even within it, the adventures that opened up. I remember at one point we were running best part of a couple of hundred kids a week, primary school kids. And somebody got word of it. They spoke to Stagecoach. I got a phone call one day out of the blue from a guy from Stagecoach and says, I've just been authorized to give you 2 double-decker buses for your kids' work.
Wow.
When do you want them?
Wow.
And I remember driving down the depot in Perth in central Scotland and driving the bus back, and even stuff like that. I've got a PCV bus license from the kids' work that we used to do. When we got involved in aid, which is another chapter, I've got a class 1 HGV because of the aid trucks we used to drive backwards and forwards. So I've ended up doing probably a million things I never thought I would ever do. It's opened more doors than I ever thought it could ever open. And none of it has been the path I thought or the way I thought. But, as we could probably all identify with looking back on our lives to this point, whenever has it been the path that we thought we would take?
UCB Ireland, more than just words, more than just music.
And that's kind of an important thing to bring across as well, because when we go, like you said, I thought I was going to be a pastor. I was going to do the Bible college, and then I was going to go back to Wales, or I'm going to pastor a church somewhere in mid Wales or whatever it was. But God went, no, I've got a different plan for you, and I've got a different path for you. And that is something that is nothing to do with pastoral care, but it has got to do with pastoral care, because, everything you did with the kids' work and everything you've done since, as long as I've known you, has been pastoral.
Yeah. And again, I think the point here that to me is to remind ourselves constantly is stop trying to put God in the box.
That's a good way. Good way of putting it.
We do it all, not that we intentionally set out to do that, but we, in our own minds, fashion and form how we think something is going to play out or work out. And, Scripture reminds us, our thoughts are not His thoughts. His ways are so much higher than our ways. And one of the biggest mistakes we all make is we try to factor in how this is going to play out or what that's going to look like and the path that's going to be. And, I mentioned this a moment ago about if we all look at our lives back the way, the path we took to get to where we are, none of us would have set up to take that path.
Exactly.
But it should also serve as a reminder to us, if that's the case in our life to date, well, we need to understand that's also going to be the case in our life moving forward and stop trying to make the plan and path out for us. The Bible says that the steps of a good person are ordered by the Lord. He makes the path straight. Our job is to walk in it, not lay the path.
It is Jeremiah 29, isn't it? I think it gets misquoted so many times, but the reality is that God has a plan for us, and it's a good one. And we need to follow his plan and what he's got for us.
I want to jump forward
primarily because of time, because there's so much going on with you in terms of what you've done in your lead up to where we are now. I want to talk about Stella's Voice. I want to talk about the work of Stella's Voice. The word trafficking. Now, my problem with the word trafficking is it's becoming diluted. We hear it so often, people just think, whatever. But actually, it is so important that we hear this and we hear what you and others and those you work with have done across nations, and lives that have been changed and saved because of the work you do. But in your words, and this is going to be a tough answer, I know it is, what does trafficking mean in your words?
It's the exploitation of somebody else for your own ends is what it is, and it's what we have been involved in trying to prevent. One of the things I often explain it, because it's, you know, it's a rabbit hole very quickly when you go down this subject, and it can go off in so many tangents. And like you said, it's becoming a buzzword.
Yeah,
it's used sometimes too willy-nilly, and like you said, it dilutes the impact of it. But the fact is this: trafficking starts around a vulnerability, and that is usually around a few key core matters. When somebody loses their place of shelter, as in their home, place to sleep, where they eat, their means of provision, either their job or the place that provided food for them, when that goes, somebody is instantly put and, you know, would kick into survival mode. You know, we all do things. We leave the house in the morning, and at no point during the day are we thinking, oh, what happens if I can't get home tonight? What happens if my home is no longer there? Mm. That happens to people. And suddenly, people's worlds are thrust into chaos, where suddenly it's like, well, I need to sleep somewhere. When am I sleeping? And I need to eat. And you haven't got long before things become desperate. And then what happens is things that you would never even think of, never mind contemplate and do before all of this happened, suddenly are options in your world because you are desperate for survival. So whether, you know, looking at situations around the world where you've got conflict zones where people en masse are migrating because they've lost, you know, the places under attack, or they've lost their place of shelter, or you've got, you know, exploitative situations as we see with the migrants crossing the channel in the UK with traffickers. But it's all around exploiting people's vulnerability, and people are taken advantage of, because people will do things for a meal or do things with the promise of shelter and provision and a future. And obviously traffickers, and whenever you see on the news and whenever you hear of a group of people, whether it be the conflict in the Middle East right now, or whether it be the conflict with Ukraine and Russia and all the different wars and things that are going on, or other parts of the world, or whether it's extreme and abject poverty, there's exploitation going on. And unfortunately, there are people out there that will exploit those situations. You know, they will take those, especially kids and minors, who are not able to fend for themselves, mm-hmm. and will sell them for prostitution.
And that's the reality as well, isn't it? They will sell them.
Yeah, literally.
It's like a transaction. When did you get involved with Stella's Voice? Or what prompted you to get involved with Stella's Voice?
Well, so the journey was, whilst here at the Bible School, in November 1989, the Berlin Wall came down.
Yeah.
In the January of 1990, just basically 2 months later, sorry, February, 3 months later, I thought, apologies, February 1990, we had 8 trucks loaded from our base here in Peterhead, and we went out to Romania to help. We'd seen what was on the news, seen what was on the TV, and just had to help. Again, this is pre-mobile phones, pre-social media, and mm-hmm. anybody having a camera and a photo. It was a set off into the unknown. Of course, went there, saw horrors beyond horrors, hospitals with situations that were just beyond description. You know, conditions you wouldn't have kept animals in. And this was the care environment for people, and orphanages and so on and so forth. Came home. One, couldn't unsee what we'd seen, but also help kept coming in. So we thought, right, we need to go and do more and you know, help people to help themselves long term to turn this around. And we did that for 6 years in Romania. In 1996, we became aware of Moldova. again, Moldova, where's that? Oh, it's the next country over, right? And off we went. And after 6 years of being shocked sideways with poverty and destitution, that you was hard to get your head around. That's the only way to explain it without getting too much detail about it. You go to Moldova after 6 years of this, and you're shocked sideways again because you've seen, now you're seeing worse than anything you've seen in Romania. And you're thinking, how can it be worse? But it was. So again, we get involved and we start helping, and it's you know, it's the instant relief. It's food and heating and, you know, clothing and stuff like that. But then it's about infrastructure, wind and water-tight buildings, clean drinking water, you know, heating, so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's education, so the kids have a future and all that sort of stuff. And we're doing this, and of course, we're kind of connected around a few key places. And you get to know the kids, you get to know. And then in the early 2000s, we discover, horror of horrors, about the trafficking. That on the 1st of June, at that point, they used to put the kids out of the orphanage. Once they turned 16, the state says, we've done our job. And en masse, there'd be this exodus of 16-year-old kids, pretty clueless about life, grown up in an institution in abject poverty. And the traffickers knew this, and so they had a field day every summer, getting hold of a bunch of victims and trafficking them.
And this is boys and girls as well, isn't it? It's not just girls.
Yes. Yeah, no, it's boys and girls, and some of it is sex trafficking, some of it is for labour,
yep,
and other exploitation, but it's all... Yeah, all traffic in some way, shape or form.
I love how you use that. It's exploitation. It's not just about one subject here. It is about multiple
yep,
ways that people's lives are exploited. And that's what trafficking is. We think of it as yep, one subject, but it's more than that. So that was early 2000s, was it, you started all that?
Well, early 2000s when we became aware of the trafficking. And then we set up homes where began to then work with the state and take the kids that would come out of the orphanages into the homes and basically teach and train them. And, you know, and the first, explain it like this. The first thing you did is you remove the vulnerability.
Hmm.
You put a roof over their head. You go, this is your home. This is your bed. This is your place of safety. This is your shelter. Your food is here. You live here.
Hmm.
So that's the first thing you do. You remove the vulnerability. You put clothes in their back, food in their belly. Because until you take care of survival, to talk about the future, they're in survival mode. They're in, where's my next meal? Where am I staying tonight? How am I going to be safe tonight? How will I stay warm in the winter?
Of course. But then how are they going to trust you?
Exactly. And then over time, and again, bearing in mind, some of these youngsters, you know, they all had a story. Some of them have lived through some pretty horrific stuff.
Mm.
Very graphic, unbelievable horrors. And what you discover is some of them, they were able to get up and almost like, you know, in no time at all, they were able to move on from it.
Right.
And they just seemed to embrace their new life and they were able to just march forward, you know, just having a struggle now and again. Others, it was a battle and they had to conquer it every day for themselves again. And everybody's different and every journey through different things. But you've got this kind of smorgasbord environment. But then they all begin to help each other. And within the environment, they're all put onto rotas to learn how to prepare the food and, you know, and do the laundry. And because they've never been involved in this. They've been in an orphanage. Food comes through the hatch at the meal times.
Of course, yeah.
So the life skills that you maybe would take for granted, they had none of it. So there was this kind of crash course over the next few years to teach them all of these things, help them with their education, providing extra tuition so they could, you know, get ahead in education and have a prospect for getting a job. So, because if you can earn a job and get an income, that's one of the key vulnerabilities you're not going to face in the future. And so that's what began that kind of journey. And obviously, whilst all of that, they were going off to school, they're going off to college, and obviously hearing the gospel at the same time.
And I have had the privilege of being with you many years ago now in Moldova, a couple of times, I think. And meeting with the lads and the girls who are in the homes and just seeing their lives changed and seeing yeah, how they're embracing life rather than continuing to live in the shadow of what might have been.
Yeah, 100%. That's exactly it. And, you know, like you said, it's many years since you and I were there together.
Yeah, it is.
And many of them, we're still friends. You know,
yeah,
they're friends on Facebook and you know, they've married, they've got their own kids, and they're loving life and living life well. And some of them are leading churches, and some of them are involved in church ministry. Some are bankers, some are...
It's remarkable.
Business people, and then just doing a whole different, what you and I would call regular, normal things. Yeah.
I remember when I was with you, actually, I was in the minibus you were driving, and one of the girls was a guide in the other minibus. And I'll never forget this. She was dropped off at a hotel. And she rang, she phoned you to say, hey, I'm at this hotel. And I've never seen a minibus do a handbrake turn, quite like the handbrake turn you did. And you shot back to the hotel. And I'm sitting in the front going, what are you doing? She said, you cannot leave her. You cannot leave her. Even today, you cannot leave her. And yeah. It wasn't that she was not a wise girl. She was, but it's the situation that she had been dropped off in. And I'll never forget that. That's a real father's heart that I saw in complete action there. I would do that for my daughter. You do for your kids. And I saw it happen right there before my eyes. I was sitting in the front seat, holding on for dear life as you're driving this minibus to get her back to make sure she was safe. What happens today? You know, we've got all of these things going on in terms of, brilliant initiatives like A21 and the March for Freedom and the Walk for Freedom, should I say, that happens every year, and awareness of what's going on. We've got movies that are out now, Sound of Freedom and other movies and other things that are happening there. But what about the reality of this? Because I think it's important to state it's not only in the countries we've mentioned. It's the biggest. The US is one of the biggest nations in the world that is a trafficking nation.
Yeah. It's a global scenario. The issue is global. The last couple of years in particular, we have been involved helping in Ukraine itself, and also Ukrainians that have fled because of the war.
So there's a lot of work going on now from Stella's Voice into Ukraine.
Heaps, yeah. There's a lot. And the reason being, one of the things we have always done is our prayer has always been, because, you know, you don't need to pray a prayer to ask if you need the help. There's help needed in so many places.
Yeah.
You know, you don't even need to say which country you would help in, because again, you could literally throw a dart at a world map and you'd hit a country where help is needed. But we were like, God, lead us, not just to do help, but to do the help you want us to do. And one of the things God began to make very clear very quickly was help regarding Ukraine. I remember very early on in the conflict, I had a call from the BBC, and they said, are you aware of any scenarios of trafficking at the minute? Because obviously there's this mass migration of people. And I said to them this, I said, no, not at the minute. I said, but I can promise you it's happening.
Yeah.
I said, sadly, with a lot of these things, it takes time before the stories get uncovered, before the issues come to light. And of course, you know, you can do a search online now and find heaps of stories of kids that have disappeared, that were put on a bus from an orphanage, supposedly to be helped, but they've never been seen from since, didn't arrive at the place they were meant to be going, and all that sort of stuff. So God has very clearly kind of been leading us in that direction the past, 2.5 years. It's hard to believe February 25 marks 3 years.
Yeah.
Since Russia invaded. And so, you know, there's still horrors going on. The news tells you that one set of headlines, but the reality with people that we're dealing with on the ground, the harsh reality on the ground is something else. You know, destitution and desperation, and of course, exploitation, because people have lost their home, their means of provision. They're desperate for a place of shelter, desperate for places, you know, for something to eat. And there are always, unfortunately, those that will set out to exploit that in people. And so we're very much at the minute, you know, committed to that. That's where we know God has led us. And at this time, we've been involved in that for quite some time. We've put loads of aid across, sometimes to areas around Ukraine, but also into Ukraine itself. And obviously, there's a lot of Ukrainians that have come to the UK that have also helped.
Mark, time is running away from us. I can't believe how quickly this is going. I want to ask you about your family, your own family. How have they embraced the work of husband and dad and what you do and how you do this? How has your family embraced that?
I'm blessed. I've got an amazing family. I've got a very supportive wife. She actually works with me in the ministry. She's just remarkable. I have no other word. She really is not just my best friend, but my best supporter, if I can use that phrase.
Yeah.
You know, and works with me and puts up with me in all that goes on. And this is not a job that I do. This is very much a calling.
Yeah.
As a song my dad used to play when I was a little boy, it was Jim Reeves' song, a very simple song that says, "We thank thee." Worth Googling it. Just a very short couple of verses. It talks about, you know, nature and creation, the fact that we were born with eyes to see these things, and you know, the fact that we can go to work, and we've just the very basics of life. And it's a song I still have it. I listen to it frequently, several times a month. And a kind of a motto of my life has been, God, never let me get complacent. Let me never lose sight of the wonder of, you know, I got out of bed this morning. Not everybody got that chance.
Yeah.
You know, my prayer has been, God, I would rather spend my health and strength helping those that don't have it than need somebody to spend theirs helping me. If you were to boil me down to about as core as you can get, that's me.
Mark, I always love spending time with you and spending time on the phone with you or on Zoom. We have these catch-ups every now and again, and it's always fun, but it's always real as well, and I'm so grateful for that. And how can people... I know, you know, we're going out to UCB Ireland right now, but there are people across you know, the UK and people across America and around the world listening. How can people find out more about Stella's Voice?
Well, one of the easiest ways is our website, stellasvoice.org.uk, but also on all the social media channels, you know, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter or X, and all these kind of things. So we're out there, and, you know, we also have the old-fashioned thing called the phone line where people can phone and talk to us.
Strange thing, that.
I must be getting old because I'm discovering more and more. It's my favourite preference of how to talk to people, because you can connect in a way you can't connect in an email. But anyway, so there's lots of ways people can get in touch with us. But you can Google us. You Google us, we'll come up straight away. You know, we're easily found if you're looking for Stella's Voice.
Right. I love what you're doing, and you know that. We've walked together for many, many, many years. And I have a heart and a passion for what the work of Stella's Voice is doing. And I long to see a day, actually, with the right reasons, that Stella's Voice is not needed. And
100%.
Wouldn't we love to see that day?
Dead right. Yeah.
Wouldn't we love to see that day? But for now it is.
Our aim is to make ourselves not wanted.
Yeah. And for now it is.
Or not needed.
It has done and continues to do great work across regions that we don't go anywhere near because, well, we just can't. But, and also literally saving hundreds of fellas and girls from a life that could be a lot worse because of their circumstances that they had nothing to do with. And that work is rolling on and continuing to roll on. And it is always a pleasure to talk to you, Mark. And it's a really important thing that we talk about this subject and say that there are people out there doing things about it and doing something about it. And your website presumably will tell people how they can support what Stella's Voice is doing and how they can help.
Yes, it's all on there on the website. You know, there's forms, and it works on a mobile device or whatever device you're on. It's convenient for people.
Stellasvoice.org.uk.
.org.uk, yes.
Mark, thank you for your time today. God bless you. And I really appreciate you being on the phone for today's edition of Focus on Friday. Thank you.
Thank you, Robbie. God bless you, bro.
UCB Ireland. Serving the church, reaching the nations.